Underwriting support for Hometown Sunday Morning from the Sharon Valley Tavern since the 1930s, serving the community with a rich history and roots dating back to the 1800s. Today, the tavern continues to serve the residents of the tri-state region with a relaxing atmosphere 7 days a week. Food, friends, and fun the old-fashioned way, 860-364-9355. You'll find them on Facebook, Sharon Valley Tavern. Associated Lightning Rod, Route 22 in Millerton, installing lightning protection for homes and businesses for well over 50 years, 518-789-4603. ALRCI.com on the web. Sagala Turnkey Housing, Route 7 in Canaan, an authorized independent builder for Westchester Modular Homes, 860-824-0019, Sagalas.com. Roaring Oaks Florist in Lakeville, Connecticut, unique designs with personal attention, roaringoaksflorist.com. Dave's TV, Route 44 in Millerton, New York, everything for home entertainment, video, audio, satellite TV, 518-789-3881, davestv.net. McEnroe Organic Farm Market, Route 22 in Millerton, open year-round 7 days a week, 518-789-4191, McEnroeOrganicFarm.com. Northeast Muffler, Route 22 in Millerton, New York, 518-789-3669. On Facebook, Northeast Muffler. Upcountry Services in Sharon, serving the northwest corner and neighboring Dutchess County for over 30 years, 800-791-2916, upcountryservices.com. McKetty's Auto Sales, Route 7 in Sheffield. They've been selling top-quality used vehicles for 42 years, standing behind what they sell. Scott, Mike, Greg, Art, and the crew guarantee the service you deserve and not pushy sales pitches, serving multiple generations with integrity and respect for 42 years. McKetty's is the place to go. 413-528-5410. Online, McKetty'sAutoSales.net. Good morning, everybody. It is 2 minutes after 9 o'clock right now. It is Sunday, August the 5th. I am Marshall Miles, and Chad is not here today. Mike is not here today. Paul is not here today. NASCAR Dave is caught in a traffic jam with 100,000 other people going to the races. But we will have Hometown Sunday Morning for the first portion of this edition of Hometown Sunday Morning. We will have, of course, our normal start to the show, and that is introduction of who's in the studio. And ladies and gentlemen, we have Patriot Larry in the studio this morning. Good morning, Larry.
Good morning, Marshall. Since when has this show ever been normal?
I know. And you know what I just found out? I just found out something, and I'm very upset. I have been announcing that the VFW post in North Canaan is Couch Pipa, and the only reason I've been saying Couch Pipa is because I heard Chad say that. I always thought it was Couch Pipa. So,
I've got my card. I can look it up.
It's just PIPA.
But it's Pipa.
I thought it was Pipa, but I was just told by somebody that I'm wrong. It's Pipa. Now
it's pronounced Pipa.
So if anybody out there, I believe the person who called me, because believe you me, over the years with me, she's been a stickler about my pronunciations. And so if anybody out there can just tell me that Chad was wrong in saying that, I will continue on now to say Pipa.
Well, my grandkids spell my name as P-I-P-A, and they call me Pipa.
That's right. Well, we'll see what it is. One other thing that I have to pass along, and I just got this in, there is a lost dog in Armenia. The dog's name is Jet. He's a Minpin, very small dog. They lost him in Armenia near Cascade Road about 5 p.m. yesterday. Their telephone number, if you found a Minpin, a very small dog, that's black, some brown, and some white, 845-373-8402. We have Minpins. Dog Jet's picture on my personal Facebook page, and it will be spread far and wide. I think already we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 shares of that. So hopefully we'll get Jet home where he belongs. But with all that being said, so it's just you, Larry, to start off the show.
Let's see if I can get everything in order.
Well, you know, hey, when's that ever stopped us?
True. And if anybody's interested in calling in, please do so. And correct me on some of these mistakes I make.
860-364-5141. All right. The floor is yours, Larry.
Okay. Good morning, hometown listeners. Today, we'll address the second and final segment of our ongoing story of the life of World War II veteran Sergeant George Phillips. For those of you who missed last week's kickoff, it involved a terrific history lesson of life in this tri-state area in the 20s through the 40s, a time when life was less complicated and much more civil. A person's word and a shake of the hand often sealed deals. Doors were mostly left unlocked, and individuals respected and honored differences of opinion. Let's get to the second part involving Sergeant George Phillips' service years, and in his own words. I graduated from Amenia High School in 43. The Army had a program where if you enlisted in the Army Reserve Specialized Technical Program, they would send you to college. I was sent to Auburn, New York College, learning a lot of subjects we might need in basic engineering. Then in November, I was sent to Fort Dix, New Jersey, for induction in the regular Army. The first thing I learned was not to trust anyone. I was robbed of $20 the first night. We worked 14 to 15 hours a day on KP, kitchen police. We were issued everything, clothes, shots, medical exams. We weren't liked by the non-coms, non-commissioned officers, because we smart kids had been sent to college. After 2 or 3 weeks, we were sent by rail to Fort Benning, Georgia. Our barracks were tar-papered huts, heated by a little sheet metal coal stove using soft coal. My bed was close to the stove. The bath and showers were down the street. Fort Benning is a huge place. Officers' candidate school turned out 90-day wonders. There was tank school, paratroopers, infantry, and whatever else. Some went on passes to Phoenix, Alabama, which is a sin city. I didn't go. There were drunks, fights, robberies, and venereal disease. After 17 weeks of basic infantry, we were sent by rail to Columbia, South Carolina. We were the Fort Jackson 87th Division, 347th Battalion, Company G, 3rd Platoon. While there, the Army dissolved the ARSTP program. They decided they didn't need us, and we were stuck in the infantry. They needed a lot more infantry than engineers. So much for the brass knowing what they were doing. We filled in for the men being sent overseas. We were up at 5 a.m., reveille at 6, chow at 7, training at 8. I got up earlier to avoid the rush to the bathrooms. We'd have physical training, lectures, close order drills, and more lectures. I didn't like the mess sergeant, as he kicked me in the behind for something I did while on KP. They wanted a few to go to cook school and baker school. I didn't go, but I wish I had. Later, the company command post and kitchen crew were a mile in the rear, sleeping in tents or captured buildings. As soldiers, we spent the nights in two-man foxholes, one man awake and one sleeping in two-hour shifts, and the nights lasted forever. If you were caught sleeping, you would get bayoneted. It was cold, but I never got sick. At Fort Jackson, we had lots of marching exercise, 25 miles every Friday night. Colonel Bodner would pass us in a jeep. He'd watch us go by, then drive up 2 or 3 miles to watch us again. He must have gotten tired of that. I was a 3rd Platoon messenger, and had a walkie-talkie radio. This was useless, as every radio in the division was on the same frequency. My entrenching tool was wire cutters. How do you dig a hole with wire cutters? Later, I picked up a shovel, and after that, a pick, too. And I never climbed a fence. In Auburn, New York, I bought a Boy Scout knife and took that with me, which was a good idea. After the war, my brother Chet borrowed it and lost it. I was PO'd after carrying it through the war. I had used it all the time. At Fort Jackson, inspection was every Saturday morning. If we failed, there were no weekend passes to Columbia to spend a little money on beers and food. If we did go, we had to be back to camp at 5 a.m. If we were late, we were considered AWOL, away without leave. Jackson was a huge camp. The 27th Division was there, too. In training, we never covered what we do with the wounded, just told to call the medical aides. During the war, though, we should have been given the wounded first aid, because the aides before the aides got there. Some just bled to death. I guess they thought it would be bad for our morale by teaching us that. We were given a lecture on gas masks. The lieutenant thought he had a smoke grenade, but instead it was Willie Pete or white phosphorus. One soldier was burned badly on his back by the grenade. They put sand and water on his back trying to put it out. I don't know how he recovered. The lieutenant was shipped out the next day, probably overseas. We had a private who wanted to get out of the army. He acted crazy, crowing and squawking like a chicken. I didn't see him anymore, so I guess he did make it out. I got promoted to private first class, which gave me $4 more a month. I had an $18.75 bond sent home every month. $10,000 in insurance was $6.50, which we had to pay for. Laundry, $2 and $3, which left me with $29 for the month. Food was plentiful and good. We ate 3,200 calories a day and worked it off. I never did like the raisin pie, okra, or grits. We were shipped to Fort Dix in November, then boarded the Queen Elizabeth bound for Scotland. There were 15,000 men on board. It was so crowded that only half could go on deck. We had two meals a day, and it was lousy food. We had fish for breakfast. They charged the U.S. for the rations. The ship had no escort, as the subs couldn't catch up. We outran them, zigzagging every 15 minutes. The only candy you could buy was Mallow Cups, some great selection. We landed 6 days later somewhere in Scotland. Then we boarded the night train for Achercham near Manchester. Before the train, we were given excellent tea by Red Cross ladies. I never saw the Red Cross while in Europe, and I still donate to them. England in the fall has rain, and fog. Training went on as usual. We were in houses with no central heating. The fireplaces burned coke, which is cold with the gas extracted. When I was on coal detail, our house got more than the others. The guys would go to the pubs. The locals would tease, "Drink up, Yanks, before your beer gets cold." I did a 3-day pass to London. I saw St. Paul's Cathedral standing with rubble all around it. It had been hit 3 times by dud bombs. If one had exploded, it had brought the whole building down. Don't tell me there's no God. There were blackouts, too. I bought fish and chips served in newspaper cones. I bought a pie in a bakery. I thought it was a fruit pie, but turned out to be mutton stew. We left England on an LST landing ship tank. We went over the side on landing nets to smaller vessels, which took us to Le Havre, France. It was flattened by U.S. and British Navy with no Germans in it. We were then trucked to the Reims, France. We had pup tents in the rain and the mud, which soaked our shoes and gave people trench foot. There were only 4 pairs of arctics for the whole platoon of 40 men. The sergeants got them, not the privates or the PFCs. When the first prisoners were captured, I was told, "Phillips, take them to battalion." There I scrounged around the aid station and found 2 overshoes, one so large I could fit my right foot in it with my own boot, not to save my feet. The rear echelon got all the needed items they wanted. It should have been in the front line. Wet feet get black and wrinkly and start to decay. We lost 30% of our men to trench foot. Nobody ever told us about massaging the feet to get the blood circulating. We were issued 2 pair of British Navy wool socks. They were great wool socks. I'd wear 1 pair and put the wet ones under my shirt to dry out. When we landed in Le Havre, France, there were no Germans in it. Later, they moved back in the rubble, and it took 6 months to clear out the city. At the end of January, lo and behold, we got shoes with leather tops and rubber bottoms. The Russians were issued boots, one size larger, to put hay or straw into them. They also mixed oil and gasoline for the weapons. When our weapons were frozen, they were urinated on to get them working. This raised hell with them, but if we were attacked, it had to be done. Our first battle was terrible. The German artillery was really heavy, and we lost 25 soldiers. The next morning at 9, we did a pickets charge on a machine gun. Nobody gave the order to charge and fire. The sergeant, lieutenant, and captain had no communication. If I did give the order, I might have gotten a medal. But who would have listened to a private? The place was Obergalsbach on the French and German border. We had no canvas tops on the trucks, so we could fire at the Luftwaffe planes. We could see all the artillery flashes and knew somebody was catching hell. It was like a continuous fireworks, a continuous grand finale. Then we attacked in Belgium. I was almost killed in Prerampy. The 3rd platoon was about 10 or 12 men, and we waded the brook and got into town. We threw a grenade in a house and heard screaming and crying, and 2 civilians came out, Palmer, Montgomery, and I didn't see the 1st platoon, so we crossed an intersection to look for them. We didn't see them, so headed back, Palmer first. When I was crossing, the tank opened up with an 88-millimeter artillery shell, and the turbulence of its passing knocked me down about 10 feet back. Then they opened with a machine gun on me. I got bullets in my K rations. UGD expletive, I said. I got across but lost my rifle. I picked up a German rifle in the ditch. When I got back to where the guys were, Sergeant Schultz lay dead in the road, hit by a mortar shell, instantly killing him, and bending his Browning automatic rifle all out of shape. It was a tough day. We were bunched up in a house with no guard outside. We were green troops, and green troops with no leader. I don't know what happened to the 1st platoon. Were they killed or captured? The next days, we attacked Bunalal and Tenneville. We went to St. Vi, but there were no Krauts there. They were retreating on foot, out of gasoline. The generals couldn't surrender their troops because Hitler would have killed their families in Germany. The Germans in a retreat would set up roadblocks with manned troops. We would have to rout them out. Most towers were just rubble with destruction everywhere. Bad memory blurs as time passes. When the skies cleared, the Air Corps blasted the Germans. There were thousands of planes attacking the retreating. The sky was full. They also dropped supplies to us. That was a nice New Year's present. As we advanced, every day was always the same. Keep moving ahead. We were dirty and unshaven after 6 weeks. My shirt collar was so dirty, I took it off and scraped the collar with my knife. At the shower, we were given clean clothes. Eisenhower stopped Patton in France by giving the gas to Montgomery for his failed Market Garden fiasco. Patton had the right idea to keep attacking and not let the crowds set up a defensive positions. We did get a break in the action and rest. You can only go so far without proper rest in order to be effective. You get burned out. One town I remember was a town of all Germany. St. Macumber and I were in a house, and I heard a shell coming in. I rushed out, hitting the dirt. Macumber followed, but he was killed. I got nicked. A Band-Aid job. The medic asked me if I wanted a Purple Heart. I turned it down, as I didn't want to worry my folks back home. Dumb me again. I knew that my brother Royal was wounded in the Hurricane Forest. With trees planted in rows close together, troops got lost in the forest. That campaign should have been bypassed. I don't remember how we crossed the Mosel River. Later at the Rhine, we were to follow the 1st Battalion and troops and boats. They were turned back by intense fire. So lucky us, we later crossed on a pontoon bridge at Boppard, Germany. Remembering we crossed the Moselle and the others. A Navy boat, 20 to 20 feet long, manned by Navy sailors. Patton stopped in the middle there to take his famous picture. He would drive to the front in his Jeep with the stars of a general on it, 3 stars. Our Jeep had a sign on it, "Looters do not delay." Speaking of looting, the officers were the worst. They could mail things back home. We couldn't. You have to carry it, which was impossible. In houses, we slept on the floor, as beds might have lice or bedbugs, but we slept, no problem, as we needed sleep whenever we could get it. I was told not to keep a diary. If captured, it would give information to the enemy. Wish I had done that. It was in Belgium that Captain Mahans asked me if I wanted to be a sergeant. I said, "No, sir, thank you." "You will be," was his answer. Months later, I was staff sergeant. PFC was paid $54 a month, sergeant $78, and staff sergeant $94. I was the platoon sergeant at 20 years old. This is what casualties do. On the job training, combat infantry got $10 per month. It should have been $1,000. Later at Fort Monmouth, New Jersey, I was promoted to tech sergeant. They couldn't do it in Europe as the company had too many sergeants on the roster who were either wounded or killed in action. There was one town where we liberated Polish prisoners. They wanted guns to kill their guards, who were probably German. After the Rhine, it was mostly riding on tanks that were advancing. I was on the lead tank in Poland, Germany, near Czechoslovakia. The city was rubble, and all the other cities were the same. There were lots of bedsheets hanging out the windows. End of the war. May 6th was a surrender. All of their troops were marching west to surrender. They were on both sides of the road, and we rode down the middle. The Autobahn was like our Taconic Parkway. I never saw the American Red Cross. At the Lucky Strike embarkation camp, we got a warm Coke. I'm sure the officers had theirs with booze. If the German troops were caught by the Russians, they were sent to Siberia and worked and starved to death. I think of captured Germans only 25,000 were returned. Between Hitler and Stalin, 50 million people died. And that was horrible. Earlier in the spring, I was sent to the battalion. I assumed I was being sent to officer candidate school. A major asked me how we could have less casualties. I told him about the four pairs of overshoes for us when the shoe packs arrived. I guess he didn't like to hear about my criticizing the command, as I didn't get to go. As an officer, you were obligated 5 more years in the reserve. Good thing I didn't go, as I would have been fighting in the Korean War, too. That episode was run by MacArthur in his castle in Japan. His protege, General Almond, was 5 miles in the rear in a trailer with a bath and heated latrine. While I was interviewed for OCS, our division liberated Buchenwald extermination camp, where 5 to 7 million Jews were killed. The next day I was asked if I wanted to see it. I refused. I had seen enough of death. The Russians would rape German women, and many of them committed suicide. It was a relief to have no more fighting and killing. Our division was slated to invade Japan in November. We had heavily bombed Japan, and there were no enemy planes. They were saving 300 planes to sink the troop transports, which would have been a bloodbath on both sides. The citizens would have been armed with bamboo spears. The atom bombs stopped the war. If anybody said we shouldn't have used those terrible bombs, I'd sure give them my unbiased opinion. They should have been there first. Drugs. Before I was going into the Army, Pop told me drugs weren't healthy. That's all I know. And I avoided them all of my life. I tried cigarettes, maybe half a pack in England, but I didn't like them. Good choice. During the war, men would have to get under their raincoats to light up at night so they didn't get shot at. After the war, codeine cough syrup was available to high school to get high. That led to more drug addiction. As a platoon sergeant, I could carry morphine syringes to give to the wounded. I never gave it to anyone not wounded or to myself. Back in the U.S., we disbanded at Fort Benning. After a 30-day leave, I was sent to Fort Monmouth, working in a finance officer, typing checks for discharged men. The checks had to be perfectly typed. I went home for the weekends, traveling by train. A few years later, we went to Fort Benning to see the new infantry museum. It cost $10 billion minus $1 to build. When I told them I'd been in the war, I got first-class treatment. In order to view the movie, they had to have 8 people signed up to see it. They showed it to just us, celebrity status. I read General Patton's book, The War as I Saw It. In it, he gave a lot of ways to avoid casualties. He should have everybody read it. Now he goes into his later years. The Edgewood Pop owned the property where the Edgewood was. It was a gas station and a beer joint, 10 cents a glass. It was closed, and Royal got the idea of building a 50 by 30 addition while Chet and I were at school in Utica. I was taking mechanical technology. Chet studied retailing. Ed Hoffman and Ted Pulver were excellent carpenters. They put up the frame and Royal finished it. When Chet and I came home on the weekends, we helped out. We opened on June 1st. Royal was the bartender. Chet worked the dining room, and I was in the kitchen. Chet was playing with one waitress. I was told by Chet that she would sue me if I caused trouble. That was the end for Chet. We put it up for sale. Al, via 4, planned to buy it, and wanted me to stay on for a while. Before the closing, he died. Spot Rotundo from Millbrook bought it. Bill Bulato was also in on the deal as bartender, but he had no money. After a while, I bought it back and ran it myself from 55 to 72. Then I sold it to Speed Buckley and Gene Handke. They then sold it to someone who owned another restaurant in Washington Hollow. By this time, it was pretty well gone. There was a fire, which was quite suspicious because all the band's electronics were missing. Our homes. In 1954, I hired Ed Hoffman and Ted Pulver to build our first house near the Amina School. They worked for the rate of $3 an hour. That was big money at the time. We built the first house on Fallen Road. It had a mansard roof and used passive solar, and Henry Krupa built it for $11 an hour. I showed Ann, my wife, the exact house on Silver Mountain, and she liked it. After a while, she started complaining about the house. I let her build her house on the lot next door. I did nothing on it. She had bought it, the lot next door, with money she had clipped from the Edgewood. She did a lot to me. I didn't care. The money was supposedly going into one pot. The Edgewood was showing $25,000 profit a year, and the IRS wanted an audit. I wrote them that our CPA was in New Jersey. This was Ann's sister, Gerda Benato's daughter, Norma Comfort. I never got audited as the IRS dropped the ball. The real estate business. After the Edgewood was sold, we bought and sold houses after fixing them up. We bought the Tower Hill property for $20,000. It had four apartments and five trailer spaces. We eventually bought about 25 houses and made a small profit, but it was okay. Then I bought the Dunbar house and rented it. Later, I bought the lot where the Blostein woodworking shop had been. Cam Fisher had a surplus store in the shop. It caught fire and burned down. He rebuilt his store on Route 22 north of town. I could have bought the 20 acres above Cam's for $20,000. Ralph Vinciarello told me that water was only a foot down, so I didn't buy it. Dumb me. I never thought of building a septic system up. It became a shopping center. Other businesses. I was interested in solar collectors. The government was offering 40% rebate on the cost of your taxes. I couldn't get too many sales. The ones I did sell are still working. After that, I sold and installed replacement windows, and then I retired. And that's the end of George's story. Now, I was doing some internet research, and I came across a letter written by General McAuliffe to the troops at the time George was serving there in the Battle of the Bulge. I'll read it to you. This was during the Christmas season. On the evening of December 1944, General McAuliffe writes his troops from headquarters, 101st Airborne Division, office of the division commander. "What's merry about all this, you ask? We're fighting. It's cold. We aren't home. All true. But what has the proud Eagle Division accomplished with its worthy comrades, the 10th Armored Division, the 705th Tank Destroyer Battalion, and all the rest, and Georgia's 87th being amongst them? Just this. We have stopped cold everything that has been thrown at us from the north, east, south, and west. We have IDs from four German panzer divisions, two German infantry divisions, and one German parachute division. These units spearheading the last desperate German lunge were headed straight west for key points where Eagle Division was hurriedly ordered to stem the advance. How effective this was done will be written in history, not alone in our division's glorious history, but in world history. The Germans actually did surround us. Their radios blared our doom. Their commander demanded our surrender in the following imprudent arrogance. He said to the U.S. commander of the encircled town of Bastogne, "The fortune of war is changing. This time the U.S. forces in near Bastogne have been encircled by strong German armored units. More German armored units have crossed the river Orthe near Orthonville, have taken up march and reached St. Hubert by passing through Hormez, Sibret, Libremont is in German hands. There is only one possibility to save the encircled U.S. troops from total annihilation, and that is for the honorable surrender of the encircled town. In order to think it over, a term of 2 hours will be granted before we begin preparation. If this proposal should be rejected, one German artillery corps and 6 heavy anti-aircraft batteries are ready to annihilate the U.S. troops in and near Bastogne. The order will be given immediately after the second hour. All the serious civilian losses caused by this artillery fire would not correspond with the well-known American humanity." Signed, the German commander. The German commander immediately received the following reply from General McAuliffe, the American commander. His reply, "Nuts, N-U-T-S, nuts." That's his entire reply, "Nuts." General McAuliffe then finishes his letter to his troops. "Allied troops are counterattacking in force. We continue to hold Bastogne. By holding Bastogne, we assure the success of the Allied armies. We know that our division commander, General Taylor, will say, 'Well done. We are giving our country and our loved ones at home a worthy Christmas present and being privileged to take part in this gallant feat of arms and truly making for ourselves a Merry Christmas.'" Signed, A.C. McAuliffe, commanding. Now, before concluding, I wish to share a heartfelt letter I received from Sergeant Phillips after asking him permission to share this story with you. I'm sure George won't mind me sharing this with you. One moment, please. George states, "World War II veterans returned to Bastogne," in George's words. "This was planned 2 years ago, but I was unable to go as planned. Left Boston on British air, extra wide and long seats, not like U.S. carriers and little cattle car seating. At the Brussels rental agency, I picked up a practically new BMW. You could hear it run, fuel efficient, soft ride. For an extra $6, that was a bargain. I spent the night in a Bastogne hotel. Came down for breakfast in my military cap with division insignia on it. Everyone recognized who I was, rock star. personality recognition. Even the school kids, their last German occupiers were very, very harsh. Met Henry, our historical guide. The first thing, he got in an argument with another guide who wanted to go with him. Henry had prearranged for the day, and we went to the mayor's office and were warmly greeted with two glasses of extra fine champagne and speeches, and I received a large medallion of the bulge. Incidentally, the mayor being a good-looking young woman. Also was a framed copy of the Nuts reply to the German officer's surrender request by General McCulloch, commander of the 101st Airborne. After the ceremony, went to the Belgium Guard and were escorted to a room with pictures of veterans who had returned to Bastogne Guards. My picture was taken, and that was where my picture would be for the next day. Then they showed me a life-size scenes of war times depicting command rooms. After that done, we went into a long building, 6 foot, all full of war tanks, U.S. Shermans, British, French, German, Czechoslovakia, and many other countries. All were in running order. My picture was taken in front of a Sherman holding an M1 rifle. I didn't realize how heavy an 8 3/4 pound M1 was. It was an impressive collection. After that, we went to see 87th Division plaques in Bastogne. At one little church or chapel, a man greeted us, led us in, and left later, returning with a U.S. canteen just found after being buried in the ground 60-some years, finally raised up by the frost. Lost by one of those 8 men who were killed in that battle. At the nearby farmhouse again, we were welcomed with a greeting to coffee. Then off to see more plaques. The country is really beautiful. Fields are cultivated right up to the edge of the highways, with no fences or divisions between the farms. I wish U.S. farms had seen this. It's perfect landscaping. I had sent maps of Priape to Henry. I asked to see Priape. Henry said this was it. Nowhere was he telling me. I guess he knew but didn't want to go, as I suspect they had bad mental effects on veterans viewing the different battle places. Our return flight was by British Air again. Glad to get back home again. Signed, Sergeant George Phillips. Conclusion. Thank you, George, for sharing this fascinating story of your life, a life involving an important time in history, history lessons that would be forgotten if left unreported. I would encourage all you veterans to write or record their military history, regardless of perceived importance. It is important to someone, important to family, friends, and military history. Thank you, Sergeant Phillips. It was an honor for me to share your story with our hometown listeners. God go with you, my friend, and God bless our military, our veterans, those protecting us foreign and domestically, and especially you faithful hometown listeners and your families. Let's pass this back to Marshall.
All right, we've got a song. Then Willie's going to call in, and then we're going to call it a day here. It's Hometown Sunday Morning.
Sun coming up over New York City.
There you go, Brooks and Don, Only in America. A very shortened version of Hometown Sunday Morning this morning. I'm Marshall Miles.
Patriot Larry.
There you go. Patriot Larry is on board. Everybody else, NASCAR Dave is caught in traffic with 100,000 other people going to Watkins Glen. That's what he called when I spoke to him on the phone. That's what he said. He said, can't talk now. Why? Because I'm with 100,000 other people in traffic. So I said, okay. As a matter of fact, he was so busy driving, Chris answered the phone. Not even Dave. Well, I don't know. I don't know if there's any ice cream. I don't think there's any ice cream involved this time. I think he was actually stuck in traffic, and he was upset. But anyways.
You have to prepare for those extenuating circumstances.
You do. You do. But he didn't. Well, anyways. Hey, but we do have Willie on the phone. Good morning, Willie.
Good morning, Marshall. Good morning, Larry.
Good morning, Willie.
Great troop tribute this morning. I have the privilege of knowing George, and he's an honorable and gentleman for sure, with a emphasis on gentle. He's a great, great guy.
Yeah, he is.
I don't know how much time you've got. I know you've got a truncated show today, but I've got a few things to report on if you're ready to listen.
We've got 11 minutes, so you've got plenty of time.
Okay. I'll talk double time. The things are heating up now. There's literally and sports-wise, there are all kinds of things going on. Today, there's the Tour of Litchfield Hills bike ride, and that's meaningful because there are bikers, bicyclists all over the place, all over our neck of the woods. Even though it starts at Coe Park in Torrington, there are many different rides they can take, including 155-mile, 100-mile rides. So they're up around the Salisbury, Canaan, Falls Village area, and it's probably a good time to talk about, for just a second, the automobile-bike dynamics. There seems to be a natural tension between the two. Sometimes you see a bicyclist in your lane as you're approaching from behind with a car, and there's almost a road rage thing that takes place. Automobile drivers need to know that bicyclists have the right to the road. They have all of the rights that a car has. And in a perfect world, if we had 8-foot shoulders and bikes could stay over there, that would be great. But they don't. We don't. Oftentimes there's no shoulder at all. And they have the right to stay to the left of that side white line. And if you come up behind them and they're going 20 and you're going 40 and there's an oncoming car, you pretty much have to wait until that car goes by and you can go safely around them. What the bicyclists have to understand, though, is that although they have all the rights to the road, they're also subject to the same rules as a car. That means you have to stop at stop signs and stop lights. It's inconvenient for a cyclist because they have to stop, they have to take their feet out of the pedal clips and so forth. But there's plenty of blame to go around, and when there are these dynamics taking place. But the point is, there are going to be a lot of bicyclists around on the secondary roads, probably on Route 7 and places like that. So even if you're in a hurry, you see bicyclists ahead of you, maybe several in a row, because there are up to 1,200 people riding today. It's a big, big ride. Just be careful. Even if you're a bicyclist, you can be right and dead at the same time. You can do everything you're supposed to, but if a car hits you, you know. Anyway, that's going on all day. This week is busy. Starting Monday, there are two golf tournaments. There's the Litchfield Open at the Torrington Country Club. That funds the Booster Club for Litchfield schools, high schools. There are two of them there. And also on the same day is the James DeSillo Canaan Exchange Club tournament. That's up at the beautiful Wyantonick Country Club in Great Barrington. And the proceeds from that fund scholarships for both Canaan and Falls Village students. And Friday, there's another tournament. It's called the Earth Angels Fight Against Cancer Golf. And that funds the Moments House. It's a cancer support organization. And next Saturday, there are five events on Saturday alone. There's the Sharon Sprint Triathlon over in Sharon, of course, that is put on by and benefits the Sharon Recreation Program. Matt Meddy is a tireless director there. He's putting on not only several runs a year, but he and the directors put on the kickball tournament a few weeks ago, and he was there cooking burgers and dogs. The guy's tireless, a great guy. And on the same day, here's one that really sounds appealing, the Sweltering Summer Ultra Marathon and 5K. That's up in Pittsfield. And whenever you see the word ultra in a race, that means that it's something big and long and difficult. And along with a marathon, the ultra part is an eight-hour endurance run. And that also benefits Moments House, same as the Earth Angels. It's a good organization. And you'll find this morning there was a Guido's race up in Great Barrington, sponsored by the Guido's Market. This time of year, if there's a race of any length, they start early just because of they can avoid the heat of the day. And also on Saturday, there's 25 Years of Hope Fun Run. This is over in Poughkeepsie. The whole thing is run within the confines of the Vassar College campus. Fun run, whenever you hear that, typically it's non-competitive. It's a run and a walk, and it's meant to raise some money but just have fun doing it. There's no real competition involved. And also Saturday, over at Undermountain Golf Course, the Ancrum Fire Company is holding their golf tournament. I'll be playing in that. And, of course, that benefits the fire company itself and the programs they've got. And last but not least, on next Saturday, is the Torrington Road Race. That's a five-mile race, and that starts at Coe Park in Torrington, and that benefits the Torrington Trails Network. They've got a expanding, very nice trail system, and they continually improve that. So that's, in a quick nutshell, is what's coming up this week. I would want to take a second to talk about an event that happened yesterday that I went to just to cover, and that was the Ice Bucket Open at the Canaan Country Club. The Ice Bucket term, you'll know, was a fundraising concept for ALS, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease, so that thus the name. And there's a gentleman who was the inspiration for this. This is the third year they've run this tournament in Canaan, Bob Frank. Contracted ALS a few short years ago, and he was a long time, I think 27-year superintendent of the course, well-known, well-loved, and his friends decided to put on a golf tournament in his honor and his benefit, which they did. It was a very rare case where you start an event for the first time and you have it full right away. Usually events take a year, two, three, 5 years to build up your attendance, but because of who he is, they've been full every year. But instead of accepting the donations, Bob insisted that it go to the ALS Association of Connecticut because he's been a beneficiary of that. It's a very active, very, very good organization that provides services and help to ALS sufferers and their families because it's, you know, the caregiver for ALS patients is daunting, for sure. Anyway, I woke up yesterday morning, I thought it was pouring out. I thought, oh, no. There are two flights at nine-hole courses. Oftentimes, if you want a lot of people, you have to do two different flights, and there was a morning flight, afternoon flight. It was raining yesterday morning. I said, oh, no. They delayed the beginning flight a little bit, 15, 20 minutes. The rain stopped. And then it just it cleared up, as you know, if you're outside at all. And they had a fully subscribed attendance, and it was very successful. So anyway, that's it in a nutshell. I think I covered it all. Lots coming up this week. Golf tournaments during the week when they typically, especially like Torrington Country Club and courses like that, they like to do weekday tournaments. So there's two tournaments on Monday, one on Friday, and then on Saturday over at Undermountain. Several running events going from a fun walk run at Vassar to an ultra marathon event next Saturday in Pittsfield. Lots going on. And all the details you can find on my website, sportingacause.com. That's it. Was that some sort of record, Marshall?
I think it's too good. Sportingacause.com. But I want to say one thing here.
Yeah.
fun run, be damned. When anybody runs, if you're running and there's somebody either ahead of you, just ahead of you, or behind you, I don't care whether it's a fun run or not. What I've seen in the past is somebody tries to beat somebody in the
game. Hey, well, you and I are jealous, Marshall, because we can't run.
Well, I was going to say, the three of us never put the word fun and run next to each other.
You're right there.
My comment to Ed Tobolsky at Housatonic Valley Regional High School, when we had to run with the presidential fitness test. I don't know if you remember that.
Oh, I remember those.
We had to take those. And when I was a freshman, Ed Tobolsky told me I had to do the 660, I think it was. And I looked at him and I said, Mr. Tobolsky, I have not yet found something that I'm scared enough to run from or something good enough that I want to run to. It didn't amuse him, and so I had to come back and run the 660. And this is because the schools used to get great. I had to come back and run it at my own time until I met a certain time so I didn't fail.
Oh, boy.
He must have been an old drill sergeant.
He was a great guy. He was a great guy.
Yeah, so he still is.
I had to run it three times, Willie, three times.
That would be the 1800, wouldn't it?
I learned my lesson to keep my mouth shut.
Did you really?
At that point, I did, anyway. As a freshman, it was very easy to keep my mouth shut. All right, Willie, your website address again?
Sportingacause.com. That's sporting, not supporting.
Yep.
Sportingacause.com. And their calendars. I do a weekly blog on where I go into a little depth on some of the causes and nonprofits and associated subjects. I hope they're interesting. Check it out.
All right. Willie, thanks for the report.
Okay.
Keep up the good work, Will.
Thank you, Larry. Thank you, Marshall. Take care.
Take care.
Bye.
All right, Larry. Well, that's going to wrap up our show here.
All right, my friend.
We're just going to go right into music after this.
Are you going to sing or am I singing first?
None of us. We're going to get some country stars.
Oh, no.
That's right.
Paul would have loved to hear us.
Farmer Paul's sleeping right now.
He's listening to polka. Anyway.
That's right. All right, Larry, we'll speak to you next week.
Okay, Marshall.
All right, and that is this abbreviated edition of Hometown Sunday Morning, but the music edition continues on for the next 2 hours.